Augustine Burrows, welcome to Queer Radio on 4ZZZ in Brisbane, and welcome to Brisbane.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It really is.
First time for you to be certainly here in Brisbane, if not Australia. And
No, I've been here before. Yeah, I've been here before. And it's always wonderful. I mean, it's such a different culture and climate from Sydney and Melbourne, you know, and it's a little bit of LA here, I think, a little bit of Malibu and Monaco all tossed together. It's great. It's a great place.
Well, this is what David Sedaris asked me, you know, do you like Brisbane? I said, I love it. It's everything's to like. It's got great climate. It's close to like crystal clear waters and great rainforest. And the weather most of the year is really quite clement.
Yeah, I mean, there's it would be odd not to love it. It wouldn't make any sense. Even when you just see it from the sky when you're flying in, it's just a little jewel. I've really, you know, this has been a different trip for me for coming to Australia. I've traveled, you know, around the world, lots of places, and it's always under the same circumstances when it's a tour. You know, it's a very tight schedule, and I'm meeting lots of people and doing lots of media, so the variables are the same. It's almost like a focus group. You can judge each place equally because the variables are identical, you know. But this time it was that dangerous love. It was that I don't think I want to go back, you know. I just don't want to go back. All of a sudden, you know, I just started really writing, you know, which I never do on tour. Never. It's impossible. Which has actually made this tour really hard because I'm up till 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. to squeeze in the writing that has to happen. But there's just something about the people that I have met, and it really hasn't mattered where the city is or what the people do, whether they're, you know, cab drivers or the guy who's bringing me an extension cord at the hotel or your very polished talk show host. Just people, the people I meet. There's a certain lack among Australians of a sort of caution or not caution. No, that's not the word. It's there's a lack of defensiveness that that I am so aware of Americans having away from it. You know, it's not that people are sort of less sophisticated here and more earnest. It's that they're more open. I'm the godfather to an Australian woman's baby. And when we first met, I was very dubious because she's an actress and she's one of the most beautiful women in the world. And I thought, you know, my friend could have done better. I mean, God, let's marry the blonde, 9-foot-tall supermodel actress. That's great going, Dan. And then I met her and she was amazing. I mean, just amazing. She had the personality of the absolute ugliest girl in the room. I mean, just, you know, as if she never, ever had any physical advantage. She's just funny and smart, but she's completely salt of the earth. I mean, there is nothing she wouldn't do for anybody. She has no elitism. There's no arrogance. And I have found that I was emailing my partner as I'm one of 15, as I'm campaigning, saying, it's a whole country of her. You got to understand, it's a whole country of these people. That's why she's like that. I've been spending time with my publicist, Jane, and it's the same thing. Yeah. Just this very open, communicative, almost gregarious quality that I just love, you know, and it goes over well. This is a place where, I mean, I've built my whole career on just, let's cut the bull. And this is a place where that goes over well. You know, they like it here. People don't seem to want the buzzwords and that. People just like, you know, get to the point, you know, and that goes over well. So I love it here. There's something special, very special about it.
Okay. In Wolf at the Table, you're talking specifically about your experience as a very young man, not virtually from childbirth, and especially regarding your relationship with your parents, mostly your father. But you would be now acutely aware that even as a godfather, you've got distinct responsibilities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was never going to write about my father. It was something that I felt was just in my past, much like I felt Running with Scissors, which is in my past. And throughout my 20s, I never thought I would write a book about it. And actually, speaking of Running with Scissors, when I did begin writing Running with Scissors, I thought I would include my father in the beginning and start the book earlier chronologically so that people could see and understand that, oh, Running with Scissors was the good part, the happy childhood. That was the dessert. But I could not summarize my father in a chapter or two. It didn't work. It wasn't effective because he could not be summarized. What made that relationship so incredibly terrifying was subtle and needed to be explained. So he died 3 years ago, and instead of feeling that wave of grief, I didn't feel sadness and I didn't feel longing. I felt free. I felt free for the first time in my life. And now I had been raised by this absolutely wild psychiatrist who believed you were a free person when you were 13. So I've never gone to school. I've never, gone through step A and B and C so you can land, at D. I have been living on my own since I was 16 and working, and I have been free. And when my father died, I realized, no, I haven't. With that awareness came the knowledge that I immediately had to write this book. And I knew it wasn't going to be a funny book. And that's the thing about A Wolf at the Table. It's really not – it's not a funny book. It's not like my other books. It's a brutal, brutal book. It's very disturbing. And I had a 5 seconds of pause. I mean, I knew I was going to write it. That was never a question. But was I going to publish it? And my only concern was I don't want to let my readers down, and, I don't want them to, come here expecting yet another funny thing. But, when I thought about it just in another moment, I realized that it seems to me that so many people have come up to me and told me that the favorite part of whatever the book is, it's always often one of the darker or more serious moments. I mean, the material in my book Dry, which is about alcoholism, and it's a love story, a very sad love story. It's the really, really devastating material about the character George or Pighead, who dies in that book that affects people. In Running with Scissors, it's the rape scene. So I thought maybe people will to accept that from me. But the more important issue was that I can't be the only person with a bad father. And if you go to the bookstore, you would certainly think I am, because all the books about father and son relationships are sports or their advice from dad to his boy. They're very sentimental books. And they're that's fine. That's fine for a certain segment of the population. But there is a huge number of men and women, too, who did not have the great father, whose father left when the baby was born, or who drank, or who was extremely violent physically or sexually abusive. I mean, it's an unfortunate list, but it is a long list, and it's common. So when I went out on tour with this, I didn't know what to expect. And what I got were the biggest crowds of my career, absolutely massive numbers of people. And so many of them came up to me and said, me too. I was married to that man. That man was my father. That man was my grand, and it was an amazing thing to see the intensity with which people felt, I think, a sense of camaraderie. I mean, when you read a memoir that perfectly expresses what you have felt but not been able to articulate, or when it describes an experience you've had and you've never seen it described before, it's profound. It makes you realize that you're not alone in the world, that you have company. I also had, of course, people come up to me, and this was a surprise, and say, I actually had a great dad. But I wanted to give this to him for Father's Day. And I thought that was I didn't understand it until I thought a little bit more about it. And why would you want to read this book if you've got a wonderful father? And I think it makes people feel grateful, which was a Running with Scissors thing. I mean, obviously lots of people who read that had normal, relatively normal, what we call normal lives, or certainly not to the extent of dysfunction that I experienced. But it's great. I love that. I love having people who had a great dad come up to me, and because they often tell their stories. I had a gentleman here in Australia come up to me, an older gentleman, and it brought the book brought back so many memories for him of just the little things in the book. And and he had a great dad, and he started sharing stories of his relationship with his father with me. And while it was as if he was saying, we used to travel to the moon, it was great. You know, it was really great.
Certainly what I've found from my experience with the book is that you're actually letting us know how you actually progressed to be who you are. It was a coming of real age for you, because you tell us that it's not just a matter of surviving childhood. You then, as a young adult, had to endure that you were going through the same situation as your father, having a public image that was one thing, a private life that was really quite messy. But you have actually been able to pull above that. And was that being able to cope, was that when your father died, or were you actually pulling your life together before that happened?
Oh, no. I mean, I've always been pulled together. And you're right. The book does put, I think, the other books in perspective. I would never actually write a book, though, that further explained my life. I'm really, in an odd way, I'm not the subject of my books. I mean, I am, but in another way, I'm absolutely not. There's really nothing special or unique about me other than my experiences that I've had and the fact that I'm able to recall them on the page. So that with full emotion, so that people, I mean, I may not be the best writer in the world. I may not have I don't have a beautiful vocabulary. I mean, I think of like Lionel Shriver, who's a gorgeous writer, and it's not a pretentious vocabulary that she has at all. She just seems to know the right word. And I don't have that. You know, I know six words basically, but I am, I'm an expert. I'm like a mechanic. I'm really, really good at bending them to do what they need to do, to say what they need to say, so that they can express the exact and precise emotion of that moment. That's something I can do. It was never my goal to give people another installment of my life, you know, like it was more to tell the story of, and I happen to be the writer of it, you know, tell the story of this relationship with this father. And people, I think, when they read these books, I mean, yeah, they definitely read me, and they, you know, they know me, but I think there's, you know, there's a lot of them in the books as well. The funny thing, it's like when Atlanta, Georgia, you know, if there's one place I can read the crudest and most offensive essay anywhere in the world, is Atlanta, Georgia, where it's a Republican audience with very high hairsprayed hair, and the men are in suits and have parts, you know, in their hair like in the 70s, and everyone's gorgeously dressed, and yet, I can say anything, because even though the window dressing of my life is perhaps very unfamiliar, very different, very strange, very shocking, the emotion is exactly the same. I mean, that's why the stuff I write about is just really universal. I mean, seeking love from a father, or, you know, wanting to fall in love, or dating all the wrong people. That's what I'm saying. There's really nothing unique or special about me in that sense, other than my ability to recall and to put on the page.
Yep. I think it is really useful, though, for gay men, lesbians, bisexuals, who go through like significantly larger proportionate incidents of oppression in the world, that you can say, well, here I am, and I've come through this extraordinarily challenging upbringing, and yet I'm happy and focused and getting on with my life.
Yeah, it's essential. I mean, there's always some sort of oppression, whether it's an emotional oppression or legal oppression or both. And the only choice I felt I've ever had was to be myself, no matter what the cost. I mean, that was just the only way I was going to ever live my life. You know, it's interesting. In terms of being gay, and this is often, I've said this before, and it always gets misquoted, so people never really understand what I mean, but I'm going to explain it now. I've often asked if I'm proud of being gay, and I'm not. I'm really not. I'm not proud of being gay any more than I'm proud of being right-handed. And the reason for that is because I never struggled with it, and I was never told it was bad. I didn't go to school. You know, I wasn't bullied in high school about it, and when I the adopted family, it just was nothing. It was not. No one ever talked about it. It was no issue. So I never overcame anything. I just have been like this since the dawn of time, and nothing changed. I never, never, never thought about it. It was never something that I even realized wasn't perfectly fine. That said, so therefore, what's to be proud of? I haven't earned the right to be proud. I didn't do anything. But I am proud when I see, and I meet them all the time, these 20-year-olds, these 22-year-olds, these 30-year-olds, even 50, 60-year-olds who grew up with extremely religious or oppressive families, who were indoctrinated since birth to believe that being gay or lesbian was the worst possible thing you could be, on a par with bestiality and pedophilia, and yet they still do it. That makes me proud. Those are the people who should be proud. And if I had overcome that level of oppression, I would be proud. But it was handed to me on a silver platter. That's the one thing about my life that that was easy, is my sexual orientation. And it's the same thing, too, with gender. I mean, you know, we made great progress in that area. And now people feel comfortable with even the concept of being gender neutral, or being, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. There's still a lot more that needs to happen. But even in that area, I think there is there's less of a stigma than there was when I was growing up. I mean, and when I see it now too. I mean, I see it, the young guys, you know, I have a huge male readership, straight guys, huge. And, you know, they show up and they've got the $85 shag haircuts and they've got the pedicures, and, you know, their wives are like, they've got short cropped hair and like really strong arms and biceps and triceps. And, you know, their wives definitely had relationships with girls in college, but realized, nah. And so, you know, this is the new modern couple, and they've got their kid, and the dad's the one who's changing the diapers and slobbering all over the baby. I mean, it used to be you could sort of tell. Who's gay? He's gay. Yeah, you can tell. You can absolutely cannot tell anymore. I mean, you know, it's been an amazing transformation, and I love seeing it. I love seeing these very sensitive. I mean, these guys come over and they cry, you know, and they're very emotional. They're just, it's not like a big, because they grew up in a world where being gay wasn't the worst thing you could be. So they, of course, were able to think about it. Am I gay? No. He's cute, but would I want to have sex with him? No, but I like his hair, and it makes them better people, and it makes them much better fathers. And I think that that's something that my generation has suffered from, is the fact that fathers born in the 1930s didn't want to raise sissies. So they were standoffish. They were aloof. They weren't physically demonstrative or emotionally available. And that's painful, and that's something I think of the vast majority of men my age, if they had a complaint about their father, it would be that they were perhaps not as emotionally available. But, you know, that has changed. That has changed. And it's and women have had a large part to do with that. I mean, the generation before mine, I spent 18 years in advertising, and every one of them I worked for women. I've worked for women all my life. Well, it's their daughters, you know, my boss, my old bosses. These are the daughters now that are coming up in the world, and they've never had oppression. They've never found a glass ceiling. The only divide among the sexes for these women is that the men, you know, they're lazier and they don't make as much money as the women. I mean, that's the reality for a lot of young women these days. You know, that there is no ceiling, there's no limit, and they work out. Their husbands don't, because guys don't work out anymore. You know, it's the new flat butt, open toed sandal guy, and it's great.
On a more serious note, two issues that I'd like you to just briefly comment on would be the need for support groups within the gay and lesbian community. And my GP, Wendell Rosevere, has, through his clinic, long-standing support groups for men affected by rape and sexual abuse and gay and lesbian alcohol and drug support. Would you say that those are two vital aspects that need to be available widely?
I do, and I think that when I went through rehab, one of the comments that one of the facilitators, chemical dependency counselors, said, and it stuck with me because it's so silly, but it's so true. She said, you know, when you get bubble gum on your shirt, what's the one thing that's going to get the bubble gum off your shirt? Bubble gum. You know, if you get bubble gum on your shirt, take your gum out of your mouth and stick it on the shirt and you'll get the bubble gum off. And addiction, alcohol, drugs, meth, I mean, whatever the addiction is, food, not eating food, is as much a social disease, and it's essential to not face that challenges of getting sober and living without drugs alone. It's hard work. It's very hard work, and it's really comforting, and you feel really safe being around other people who know, who just know. I mean, the day I walked into rehab, it was – I looked around at those losers in that room and I was horrified. I mean, not only were none of them dateable, but even worse, I just thought they were all like so alcoholic. You know, I mean, I was bad, but not that bad. And these people were that bad. And then it was on the couple days later when we had to do our sort of inventory of the amounts we consumed. And it turned out I actually was the heaviest drinker out of everybody there. Now, when these people started to tell their stories, I just sat there with my jaw open because each one was telling one dimension, one aspect of my own story, my own life. So there's a great deal of power in being with your peeps, you know, and in sharing your experiences. It's like that's why people like memoirs. It makes you realize you're not alone and you don't have to do it alone. So I think that's it is something that the community has to make available to people, and that gay people and lesbians should take advantage of and not be intimidated by. You know, I think that one thing that holds people back from seeking treatment is the fear, you know, that they won't like the people in the treatment or that they'll be rejected or something. And that's a fear everyone has. And it's the opposite. I have found it's the opposite 100% of the time, you know. These are the people who are going to be supportive and who want to see you win and who want to see you healthy and do good. You know, and rape and sexual abuse is something that's the gift that really does truly keep on giving the rest of your life, and it creates its own special baggage. It's incredibly frustrating to be 30, 40, 50 and experiencing intimacy issues and sexual dysfunction and wanting to be able to connect sex and love, perhaps even meeting and falling in love with somebody and yet not being able to have sex with them and not understanding why you can't have sex with them, but being able to have sex with the most unattractive person that you meet who's a stranger. All that stuff, that's the stuff we get when we're sexually abused. And if you don't go in to your brain and root around in there, the behavior just continues. It doesn't get better on its own. I mean, that's something that you've really, really, really got to, you've got to figure out and work on. And there are tools that you can, gain from going into a counseling program or to a therapy environment or group therapy environment or a support group. There are things you can do to relax yourself and to learn to recognize when that behavior is floating to the surface. This is all stuff I've gone through, so I'm speaking from experience. This isn't something I read in a textbook. And it's something that greatly minimizes the quality of your life.
Thank you very much, Augustine.
Thank you for your time.